Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. If the committee can come to order, please. Representative Nelson, House File 3566.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Whoop, that Mr. Chair, apparently it is there.
Yeah, every one of these is different, you know.
Absolutely. Representative Nelson, if you'd like to move that House File 3566 be recommended to pass, then we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
I would like to move that to the flip set.
All right. Thank you. Then we have a, am I correct that we have an amendment?
We have an amendment here, the 3566A1 amendment. And basically what this amendment does is it takes a portion that's currently codified in the workers' comp law and has to do with investments and where they have to have their investments at, and moves it to the commerce section of law. And it's been agreed to by both labor and the Chamber of Commerce, and so I'd like to move this amendment.
All right, and this gets the bill in the form that you'd prefer.
Yes.
Any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So the bill is amended, Representative Nelson.
I'm just going to walk through the bill here. Get my stuff together here. Anyway, in the bill here, if you go through the bill, Section 1, it clarifies, a provision here clarifies who's responsible for workers' compensation. Dealing with, can you get me read what I wrote here in my notes? Okay. It's who's responsible for workers' compensation coverage, the personal care assistant. Currently, there are people that work in people's homes as personal care assistants, and there's been some differences about who covers them under workers' compensation. It's gone into where a couple of situations where people that are getting the care have the opportunity to pick these people, and so there's been some question whether they're the employer or the agency, the third-party agency that's sending the people out there are the one that's supposed to have workers' comp on them. And this clarifies that the people, it's the third-party agency that's, and not the patient or the injured worker who's responsible for the workers' compensation on these people. And that's all that this section does. Section 2 just adds a cross-reference to the independent contractor bill that was passed last year. It's covered by it, but just references it so that there's no confusion that workers' compensation is important to that in that part. And that's on page 6. Section 3 is probably the crux of the bill, and the way the bill should be passed is it increases the weekly compensation for $750 a week to $850 a week for persons that are in total temporary disability. And it increases the benefit from 104 weeks to 130 weeks. And it currently has been at $750 since 1995. And this just moves that, increases that put by inflation. These people that are off injured, the amount of money they can get so they can pay their bill. Section 4 increases the maximum hourly rate of qualified rehabilitation consultants from $88.06 to $91 a month. Or excuse me, an hour, to keep up with inflation, and otherwise they would have been capped at 2%, and they've been falling behind, and they've been having trouble getting people qualified to be qualified rehabilitation consultants. Okay. Section 5 extends the time frame that injured workers can request retraining benefits. The reason this has been put in there was explained to me was, currently, there's some people, when they get an injury, they have to have an operation. They get to rehabilitation. Sometimes they have to go to have a second operation, and they're bumping up on that maximum. They may or may not be able to go back to work. This gives them time to have a second operation and then get rehabilitated and be able to see, well, can I go back to my old job, or do I have to get retraining into a new job? And this just extends the period up from 208 weeks or up to 208 weeks from 156 weeks. They can request this retraining and get retraining under workers' compensation. Section 6, follow my bill here, page 11. This increases the total. Section 5, I'm just okay. Section 6. Section 6, and this is probably the most controversial, prohibits unlicensed people from being compensated, unlicensed care providers from getting compensated, unless they're working for a doctor's office or a chiropractor's office that is licensed. But somebody can't set up a massage parlor on Lake Street or someplace out of their home if they're not licensed or registered with the Department of Health or whatever. And that's what that prevents them from getting paid for unworking compensation. That came out of the commissioner's office. That's going forward. Section 7, and this is the part that has to do with rulemaking. This is a page here where I wrote my notes. This is a process that allows for expedited rulemaking to update the compensation relative value fee schedule by incorporating references to Medicare. This is so that we can get some savings out of the system. This is where we're going to get the savings out of the system to help pay for the benefits. And it's savings to employers because as the system gets different things get brought into the system, currently they're not on the rate schedule, and this allows them to, by reference to the Medicare rate, to be able to bring those in. And it actually, by having them on the fee schedule, they're charged at a lower rate. Because currently, if they're off the fee schedule, they're charged at a higher rate. So this is where we're going to get some savings out of the system for employers to help pay for the benefit increases that we're giving here. It also allows Dolly to link up to the Medicare system, and so they can reference this on an ongoing basis and then change these rates that's going forward as the rate changes with Medicare. Section 8 provides that healthcare providers who are located out of the state shall be paid the rates of the providers who would receive if the compensation was provided in the state. Currently, what happens, this is another place where we're getting some savings. Currently, if it's, the examples would be like Fargo and Moorhead. If you would go across the hospital in Fargo and get treated, you're going to get paid the same. The hospitals are going to be compensated at the same rate as if they were paid for the services done in Minnesota. Currently, what is happening is they're getting paid the usual and customary, which a lot of times is a higher rate, and so therefore this is another way of getting some savings out into the system. The next section, Section 9 of the bill. Get my page, get my notes. Section 9 of the bill removes the financial limitations that employers must meet before entering into the workers' compensation collective bargaining agreement. Currently in the building trades, they have the workers' compensation as an alternative dispute resolution system where injured workers, when they get to a dispute, they go to the system and they sit down, instead of getting lawyers involved in it, they sit down and they work the differences out. And this is another way that it's, in the construction industry, it's worked really well. It's saved money in the system. It's got people the benefits that they're supposed to, gotten paid for the benefits that they're supposed to get. And without having to get lawyers involved and going to lawsuits and delaying the payment, it's worked real well to keep costs down in the workers' compensation for the construction industry. They're trying to expand this to other industries. There's a cap on there. There's a $2 million cap that they had to have. This removes that financial limit, that $2 million, so that other employers who are interested in doing the same type of system can get into that and do that. Section 10. Section 10 just clarifies that for workers' compensation injuries that the Department of Labor and Industry can go outside their normal procurement system to buy equipment. And what just happens is where employers and payments come out of the special compensation fund, and they need to get somebody a wheelchair or crutches in a hurry, they're able to go outside the system and buy it without having to go through the normal bid procedure. I mean, it's a time saving, and it's not meant to go outside that for other than that. But if when somebody needs a wheelchair, they need a wheelchair right now. You can't put it out on bid and go through that whole process. This is the way they can get it. Get the care that they need. Section 11 ensures that a workers' compensation benefits continuation. Right now, some big employers, when they dispute the claims, they fall back onto the Minnesota Insurance Guarantee Association, and there's some question about who pays for this. This is a way, by doing this, there's provisions in this in the bill. If you look at it, there's some penalties against people that refuse to apply or supply benefits, and allows MIGA to go after them and get those and get the payments. And what it does is make sure that the payments are going, the workers' compensation payments are going, the medical bills are being paid for the injured worker. They're not having to wait while there's a dispute going on. And it allows the large employers that are not self-insured, are not paying into the, or who are self-insured and not paying into the MIGA, that their injured workers are going to get the compensation they need, and then they're going to fight over who pays for it and get that taken care of if somebody's wrongly doing it, if there are penalties in there against those employers. Section 12 of the bill. Section 12 of the bill adds QRCs and rehab workers or rehab vendors to the list of people who can be fined for not turning in forms in a timely fashion. Currently, but there's been some issue with that, so that they can't get payments done on time. Section 13 is another way they're trying to get some savings out of the system. It allows the Department of Labor and Industry, instead of having to audit every single bill, that they can set up like business, audit type system. Sigma 6 is listed in here, but it's a similar system that where instead of looking at every bill, they can pick out random bills and look for differences or look for things that are outside the norm and then try and fix those and try and come back to so that just like in business, when you're making ball bearings, you don't test every ball bearing. You pick one or one out of 100 and you test it to make sure and use that as a sampling type process. That's what this the same thing type does. And again, it's to help get savings out of the system and trying to allow them to audit in a way that they're having a problem with a certain type of procedure that's acting up or coming up that's falling outside the norm, that they can audit just that one segment of the system and try and find out and try and figure out what the problem is and get it back into the norm. Section 13. Right there. Section 13. That's Section 13 I just talked about. Okay. Section 14. Section 14, because of all the issues about around Social Security and Social Security numbers and people's identity theft, this is actually helping in that. It's currently workers' compensation, all the forms have a person's Social Security number on it. This allows the Department of Labor and Industry to develop another type of system, a numbering system, an identification system, so that a person's Social Security number is not on those forms. And it will help with identity theft issues. Section 15. It allows for digital signatures, electronic signatures on forms. Currently, the workers' compensation is a form-based system. Everything is tied to the form. They're trying to get some efficiencies out of the system, moving to an electronic-based system or a data-driven system, and this will allow them to start moving in that direction where being able to fix things electronically, signatures on there electronically, stuff being faxed electronically, so those forms, so they can work towards getting this stuff run by data on a computer instead of having paper forms that people have to deal with. Section 16 updates cross references in light of the repeal of Statute 176669, and Section 17 also has to do with repealing an obsolete system relating to stuff dealing with funding from 1943 and no longer applicable. And with that, I guess I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Are there any questions on House File 3566? Representative Gunther.
I have a comment more than a question. I think this is a good effort of trying to get injured workers more money at the same time lower work comp costs for employers. We ran into a few stumbling blocks. A few people did not want to comply, and what we did is, instead of giving them a few benefits that they wanted, we just said, fine, if you don't give us the efficiencies we want, you don't get the benefits we were offering. So I think this was a very good effort by all parties to lower the cost of work comp and to get injured workers better treatment. So I think this is a very good bill, and wholeheartedly recommend its passage.
Very good. Other questions for the author? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 3566? Seeing none, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 3566 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the, as amended, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Members, there's a couple of members who are needed in other committees for votes at this time. So out of respect for the process here, we will adjourn to the call of the chair. Yeah, better yet, recess. Thank you. Good catch. That's why we keep him around. Recess for the call of the chair. Thank you. I'm going to go get some coffee.
I can use the meter.
Yeah.
Well, I can use the meter.
Thank you. Good. Thank you. We're not going to be doing anything here.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to recess. I looked at my phone. It might have been 10:38. Mr. Pender, what did you do to run them all off?
I don't know, but I'm getting a lot of work done here. Luckily, I don't have to go anywhere to vote.
We're in recess. We're in recess.
How long?
How are the days?
Well, that's fine.
You don't get that stuff done? Okay.
I'm sure I just can't run out.
No, but really, wow, that's the thing. That was shut things down.
It's like break off on them. It's like those KDA renders. We need those.
And he confirmed and said that the predatory lending subprime loan is what TJ is in the predatory lending that refers to. I'm hoping that this will be
Was the best
of all.
I'm foreclosing on you. And I send you the note. And I know darn well you are actually the landlord. I'm trying to close your phone. Reside with your tenant. So, the tenant is the applicant, not the owner. I'm not going as if the property is owned at some secondary dealer fee that it had no business doing. He's diverting the rent payment to his own pocket, not paying the mortgages. What happened? They had no business doing the mortgage, they had no business being in the deal. That's what it was. Hmm? You were reading about how to make $1 million, you got $2 in your pocket. Mm-hmm. That's what down there in deep pit, the condo was. Right now, it's killing a little bit. And let me see if it can turn around. Now, some of the things I'm ready to buy in to take time. That you better make sure that there's the 30 children or 20 on the board, because you're all going to share in the lawn mowing and the. And the time you better make sure there's enough other people to help you pay for this. Up with going on the Carlisle, the big one downtown. The people are renting them out and are trying to save them. And it's not enough people that have vested interest to help pay the common area. And it's just sucking them up. Kind of when they're trying to push the state news in. And one of their paralegals is renting on a 1 year lease at Carlisle. Something like $1,400 a month, which is $200 a month less than the common area. So whoever owns that puppy is going negative. The PI plus $200 from the common. So Charlie barred the door. Hmm. You can't live
sitting in sleep. Well, I think you are defined as a sitting duck right now.
He's had a couple
over 2 years. And why not?
To know why
okay, yeah, what it is.
So
talking about their issues. So Deb would want us to let, well, we were getting something in writing, and then we would let me know and let her know. Because we'd like to try and move it.
Murray just wants to know
Okay, well, we'll come back on Monday. Thank you. And you'll be back here at 9 o'clock on Monday morning anyway, so we'll know where to find you.
I'll even call you.
Hi, Megan. It's John here. Would you, when Bob Clemenhagen shows up with, from the Senior Federation, would you give him my apologies that our committee will not be...
You took your throne, sir.
Well done. Let's see. I need to. Thank you.
On what? I used to like them too.
I'll forward you a summary of the email. The summary.
He's back in session. Representative Dabney, are you prepared to introduce House File 3236 at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move that House File 3236 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Representative Dabney has moved House File 3236 to be recommended to be passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. I understand you have an amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and members. Does H3236A1 amendment in your packet?
Representative Dabney moves to amend House File 3236. Any discussion? Any amendments to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Mr. Chair, we might have an amendment to the bill as amended here. One moment, please.
Oh, it's correct. Wait a minute. Okay.
Well, hot diggity, we got it right the first time, though, Chair.
Very good.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the first of two bills today that we were referring to as tweaks bills. They relate to legislation that was passed last year where there needs to be some slight changes either to clarify some interpretations or do some things that I would describe as rising to slightly above a reviser's bill in terms of some changes, but not significantly above that. This bill relates to the predatory lending legislation that was passed last year, expands some definitions, and does some coordinating. With me today is Mr. Ron Elwood from the Minnesota Legal Services Advocacy Project. He can very briefly discuss the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Elwood. Will you identify yourself and give your name, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Elwood, Legal Services Advocacy Project. We're the advocacy arm of the Legal Aid Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I very briefly explain what this bill does. As Representative Dabney pointed out, for the most part, this really is a cleanup bill from last year. If I could go a little bit out of order and start with actually Section 2 on page, starting on page 5, line 13, the actual the change is actually on page 8, line 19. And what that particular provision does is when we passed the predatory lending law last year, essentially outlined stated income loans and no-doc loans, but we also made it, or we thought we made it crystal clear that all other sorts of loans are absolutely permissible under Minnesota law, and that there's some language talking about nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent an originator from using other criteria, and it's important that they just verify the income, but other than that, we didn't think this would cause any problems. We thought this was sufficient comfort language for the financial markets,
to be able to lend in Minnesota. So we thought we created a nice armchair for them, but apparently they'd like the sofa. And so what we did, make it expressly clear here this year that VHA loans, streamline loans, which are always to the benefit of the borrower because they provide a lower interest rate, and the amendment then also includes loans that are made under criteria promulgated by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's just saying they're expressly permitted. We didn't feel that it was necessary last year, but the markets are just to provide more reassurance to the markets, and that's what this amendment does. And then the second provision in this that's really significant is back on page one. And what this does, it came out of the mortgage foreclosure group that were working over the interim on the foreclosure crisis. And one of the ideas that emerged was to provide more protection for contracts for deed vendees under the statute that we have. Currently, the protections were available only for loans under $100,000. And despite the burp in the markets right now, maybe it's more than a burp, but whatever, I mean, where the property values are lower, I think we all can acknowledge that $100,000 is a fairly outdated number, so we're simply raising the cap within which the protections for contracts for deeds are available to $300,000. And that's what this bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Take me through, before you went to the suggesting a 300 cap, and your contract limit was $100,000, and I made a contract for deed to Sarah, that's my daughter, who never leaves home, and it's $150,000. What am I able to do because it's over the 100 cap today?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, there would be no limit to the rate that you could charge.
Right. And thank you. And the rationale for that has been.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, like all other financial transactions under Minnesota law, that are governed under our law, we set some kind of rational limits for how much a ceiling on what can be charged. So, for example, a Minnesota bank issuing a credit card can charge no more than 33% interest. That's just one example. There are many threat statutes.
So with the passage of this, I would be limited to Sarah's contract for deed at what kind of a rate?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, a great question. I apologize for not actually stating that up front. It is tied to Section 4720, which then provides for an index rate based on a 30-year note plus 4%, which right now is about 9 or 10%, 9.5%, I think.
Representative Pearson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that going to be realistic? Here's my point. The contract for deed market has been a wonderful way for people to get in the home under contract for deed at some point in time, being able to pay it off and take it as a regular mortgage and then become the fee title holder of the property. For under the contract, the fee title stays with the lender. How am I going to have an incentive to do a contract for deed for Sarah if I can only charge her 9%?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, while it has also been a good opportunity for people to get into the homeownership realm, it has also been an area that's rife with abuse, as we from Legal Aid can tell you. These are essentially rent-to-own transactions.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea would be if you miss one single payment, you can have been paying this contract for deed payment for 5 years, 10 years, you miss one payment, you're done. You lose all your payments and you have no equity. So
that's the reason I do it with Sarah. Okay, go ahead.
You don't. Mr. Chair and members, so the idea here is to tie the cap to a market-based index that fluctuates and reflects the current fairness in the market. And so it is the basis that is used under 4720 for other financial transactions. And I should add that the Minnesota Bank Association and the Minnesota Credit Union Association, the independent bankers groups, were all part of the development of this proposal through those mortgage foreclosure groups that we work together on, and they are in support of this as well.
But their incentive, they have an incentive to shut this thing down because they eventually become the bank. I mean, my concern is if you penalize this lender vehicle of contracts, like payday lending, you're taking an enormous resource out of the housing market, potentially. And it may be good intentions, but the concern is you might just shut it down. And
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, first of all, I'm not sure I characterize that as a penalty, number one. Number two, the banks do very little of these things. And number three, I would submit to you that if I were to get a return of, 10% on my investment, I wouldn't cry too much. I think that's a pretty fair return on my investment. And as I said before, I think that the objective of this was in the context of the creating more protections for borrowers and the problems that we have seen with abuses in contracts for deed. Transactions at legal aid, I think, really warrants putting the fact is that there were protections for borrowers at $100,000 now, and all we're really doing is moving that up to $300,000 based on the new market. And the final thing I would say on this is we're actually providing additional incentives to do contracts for deeds because we're moving it to a market rate, whereas before at $100,000 it was tied to the usury rate, which is 6% or 8% if it's in writing, but no more. It's not a fluctuating market-based rate.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to the committee if I'm obstructing. But my understanding in all the years that I've been in this world, the typical contract holder was the seller of the house. They find a neighbor that wants to buy. Sarah wants to buy my house. Sarah can't get qualified for a mortgage. So I say, okay, Sarah, I'll sell it to you, and I'll carry it on contract for deed. And then I can take that contract for deed, and I go into the secondary market, and I can sell that contract. There are people out there who buy contracts for deed. And I'll sell it at a discount. And if you've now limited that rate to 9%, instead of selling at a 10% discount, I may have to sell it at a 20% discount in order to get my cash out of the deal. And I can make the deal with Sarah. Look, if you ever get into problems, I'll bail you out anyway. Always have, always will. But, I mean, the consideration of the secondary market, and typically the contract holder is a seller. And it's not some dark person out there running around with a briefcase full of money. That's the secondary market, not the primary contract lender.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, again, I would point out that the very same issue you're concerned with exists today,
right,
except at $100,000. There are very few homes you can buy at $100,000 today. So all we're really doing is reflecting the new world of property values that are where $300,000 seems to be more reasonable in 2008. And I don't even know when this law was passed, but it certainly, I'm sure it was years and years ago when $100,000 seemed to be in the ballpark. Now that's just completely outdated. So really all we're doing, when you boil it all down, is just moving the cap to where property values are today and actually improving the return on investment because it's higher under our revision than it is under the usury law today.
Any other questions for Elwood? Anyone else who would wish to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, would you like to have a...
Chair members, Brown is the new black, Chairman Townsend is the new 100,000. Please vote yes.
Representative Dabney moves. renews his motion to pass House File 3236 as amended. Do we refer it to the Committee on Commerce and Labor? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you. And I believe we have another bill.
We do. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3287 to be before the committee with a recommendation to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Thank you for the assistance from the chair.
Representative Dabney moves House File 3287 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Now, is there an amendment with this one?
No, I don't believe there is, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 3287 is again a cleanup bill, this time from legislation that we passed last year regarding management plan. Inadvertently, we left out a couple of accreditation services that accredit legitimate debt management providers in Minnesota. We did not intend to do that. We did not want to shut down either the good nonprofits in Minnesota who are providing assistance to individuals attempting to avoid foreclosure, bankruptcy, or both, nor did we want to damage their clients' access to those services. Beyond that, this is just some updating of language and dates. I'm not aware of any controversy or any opposition to this bill. Mm-hmm. With me then is Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. I just want to publicly thank the Department of Commerce. We work with them on this bill and these amendments. Some of the problems that occurred inadvertently from last year, they were extremely helpful in making sure that things flowed smoothly between the time of the passage last year and the identification of some of these problems we're fixing here and this year when we're going to correct those. So I just want to acknowledge their help and thank them for their assistance.
And Mr. Chair, let me join in that as well. They were very gracious and really looked out for the interests of Minnesotans in the process.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Any questions from the committee? Representative Pearson.
So this would be basically their continuing education credits and some of those kinds of things?
And Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, no, actually it's not that. There are a couple of things. For example, there were some rules that were repealed as a result of the enactment of this statute last year. We put in a new chapter of law. There was one rule that talked about the filing of annual reports. So the department had suggested we put that in statute now that the rules were repealed. Things like that and some other kind of mechanical things to make this work better for the department and that's basically it.
Any other questions from the committee? Is there anyone here who would like to speak for or against this particular bill? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, would you like to renew your motion to pass House File 3287 and we refer it to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
I would.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? We need to do a little cleanup work here. We need to move some previous minutes. Would Representative Fritz be willing to move February 22nd?
So move.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And Representative Fritz, would you also be willing to move February 29th minutes? Any questions? Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Well, Representative Dabney, we're back again.
We are. It's getting to be a habit, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move your House File 3612 at this time?
I'd like to move House File 3612 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Representative Dabney moves House File 3512. Be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
3612.
Oh. All right. What's this? All right. Terrible error on the outline here.
We can agree on 3612. We can keep going.
All right. Moves House File 3612. Recommended to pass and we move to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Remember that this time, the page is passing around an article from this morning's Star Tribune. The nation's housing gloom deepens. Nervous homeowners and economic analysts have been wondering how much worse the housing market could get. On Thursday, they got their answer. Plenty. Nationally, foreclosures are at an all-time high. For the first time since 1945, the average homeowner owes more on their property than they have in equity on their property. Last month in Minnesota and Hennepin County, the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office participated in more foreclosures than they ever had in history. The map behind me, thank you. The map behind me shows foreclosure rates across Minnesota by county in 2007, based on actual foreclosures in the first three quarters of the year. You can see the sharp spikes. In 2007, home values in Minnesota, looking at home sales, dropped 8%. We are in a crisis, and it is time for bold, balanced leadership to avoid preventable foreclosures in Minnesota. House File 3612 provides a needed foreclosure deferment to a certain tightly bracketed class of homeowners, giving homeowners and lenders time that they need to bring forward the tools that are increasingly brought to the table by local, state, and federal governments, nonprofits, and private corporations to try to stem the current foreclosure crisis. It'll shield neighborhoods from the increasingly corrosive impact of multiple foreclosures, stabilize the real estate market for all Minnesotans, and protect their home values from further decline. The only homeowners eligible under this need to meet the following criteria. This is a targeted opportunity of assistance for owner-occupied property, where the owner commits to continue to occupy the property for the entire period of the deferment, for the owner who's continuing to make payments on the mortgage, either the original payment level when they got the mortgage, or 65% of the higher rate, assuming that it is reset to a higher rate, when they owned either a subprime loan purchased between August 1st of 2007, or a negatively amortizing loan, and provide them with the time they need to work out mutually agreeable and mutually beneficial agreements with their lenders. Earlier this week, Fed Chairman Bernanke called on lenders to cut principal as a way of assisting homeowners and stemming the foreclosure crisis. He also released a study from the Federal Reserve that shows when a bank or a lender of any sort forecloses on a property, on average, it costs them 50% of the principal on the property. If we can provide greater stability for the Minnesota housing market, we can stem the cost of foreclosure and the tragedy that is to individuals, as well as stemming the cost in providing assistance to the real estate market and the lending industry. With me today is Professor Prentice Cox from the University of Minnesota, who will be able to walk through the bill in more detail.
Representative Dabney, before we hear the testimony from Mr. Cox, I do believe you have an A1 amendment for this bill.
My apologies. If I could move the H3612 A1 amendment to be before the committee to get the bill in the order I would prefer.
Representative Dabney moves H3612A1 amendment to the bill. Any discussion?
Could we have the amendment described to us, please?
Representative Dabney.
Yes, copy. Of
course.
One moment, please. Okay. I'll ask Professor Cox to walk through the amendment. He's been involved in the technical drafting of the bill.
Professor Cox, welcome to the committee, and if you identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prentice Cox, Associate Professor of Clinical Law, University of Minnesota Law School. This is mostly, these are small changes. The only substantive one is the deletion of the the criminal penalty from the bill. The other changes are just to add a line in the notice that identifies the address to which a borrower can send a payment, which we'll talk about in a minute, and to change the language from eligible foreclosed borrowers to each borrower who has an eligible foreclosed loan, and there's a reason for that within the structure of the bill that I can get to in a minute, and then it also shortens the notice that goes to homeowners, so it's easier to read.
All right. Thank you. See no other questions. Representative Gavney moves this amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Gavney and Mr. Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gavney. Representative Gavney laid out the basic structure of the bill. I'll be very brief to fill in just some of the details. The bill provides the right of each lender to obtain a deferment, of each borrower who meets the specified criteria to obtain a deferment. There is no automatic action that occurs. Therefore, borrowers are given notices at the beginning of the foreclosure process of their right to obtain this deferment. The borrower has to file an affidavit of deferment stating that they believe they meet the conditions for deferment. And at that point, the deferment is effective to stop the foreclosure sale. It only applies to stop foreclosure sales. If a borrower is in a redemption period, it does not apply. Once the foreclosure sale, once the borrower, excuse me, been testifying all morning, once the lender receives the affidavit of deferment, the lender can object as to the eligibility of the loan for the deferment. And that, in very likely, would be the lender's determination that the loan is neither subprime nor negative amortizing. If so, the lender provides a notice to the borrower that the affidavit of deferment has been rejected, and it is incumbent upon the borrower then to obtain legal action at that point. The lender can bring an action if they believe the borrower has made a false representation as to being an owner-occupant in the house. Otherwise, upon filing the affidavit of deferment, the foreclosure sale is deferred for 1 year, contingent upon the borrower making timely payments. So it's a shared pain here. Borrower has responsibilities as well, and in this case, if the borrower does not make the required payment in a timely manner, he or she loses the right to the deferment, and the lender can foreclose. The law also provides a notice to the borrower monthly as to the amounts that are owed and when the amount is owed. Finally, there is a resolution of disputes and a somewhat different enforcement provision here. As I mentioned, the lender has the right to simply reject the affidavit if the lender believes it is not an eligible foreclosed loan. There is an enforcement provision which only applies to bad faith or reckless violations by the lender. So a foreclosing lender that in bad faith or recklessly denies, violates the section in any way, including denying the deferment, would be subject to statutory damages of a substantial amount, $25,000, as well as punitive damages in an amount to be determined by the court. But again, that's very narrow. The borrower would have to establish that the lender acted intentionally or recklessly. So that's a perfectly high standard. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, typically, how long does it take to have a mortgage foreclosure process completed in today's environment, especially?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, there are two phases to the foreclosure process, essentially. During the first one, the homeowner receives it's rather odd in Minnesota, actually, it's the person in possession of the property receives the notice. The borrower may actually never receive a notice in the odd case, but that's for another time. Person possessing the property receives a notice of foreclosure. It's published repeatedly in a newspaper. Although if you read the statute, it sounds like it only takes 6 weeks. As a practical matter, from the time you first default, it's going to take about 6 months until the foreclosure sale actually occurs, particularly in today's environment, 4 to 6 months. During that period, you have the right to reinstate the loan by paying the arrearage. After the foreclosure sale, there's the second phase, which is a six-month redemption period. And during that period, the borrower can retain possession of the property, but during that six-month period has the right to redeem the loan, yet has to pay the full amount that's owed at that point. So it takes about a year.
President Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, you said in a timely way. What is your definition of timely?
That's a cost.
Because that can be different for about everything there is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, if you pass the bill, it'll be the bill's definition of timely. And you can find that on 4.9, really. The payment shall be made no later than the 15th day of the month. The borrower has a heavy burden here as well. This is only meant for people who can make some payments to keep this thing going.
Representative Peterson.
Appreciate your being here, sir, because you bring a great reputation and a great credibility to it, and you sure look good in a bow tie with that outfit. You would raise your...
I actually thought bow ties were standard for law professionals.
What reaction is going to come from the lending community? And is this some way going to potentially damage the lending market for Minnesota?
Mr. Klaus.
There are representatives, Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, there are representatives of the lending community in the room. I've had numerous conversations with them, so rather than have either Professor Costa or I speculate, why don't we hear from them instead?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. But I'll bet Professor Cox has an idea. Would you care to prophesy on what will happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, after your sartorial attack, I'll stick with Representative Dabney.
Scott, we also have separation of church and state here, so. Any other discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you guys, Representative Dabney, can you tell me, on the remaining 35%, is that going to be... Are they going to have to eat those costs, or what happens there, the 35%, what happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you, because it's a great question. Because the bill doesn't tell us what happens to these loans. The intent of this bill is to provide lenders and borrowers with the time they need to access the tools that either are already on the table, the Hope Now Alliance, for instance, Minnesota's own homeowner education and training program that does foreclosure prevention counseling, and hopefully new tools that are coming forward from other elements of the public sector, private and nonprofit sectors, including providing time for a new president and a new Congress that we know will take office next January to get into office and respond. It allows each loan to be discussed between the lender and the borrower, and terms to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
Representative Anderson.
What sticks out with me is, you know, you have a pretty fairly new Congress right now, and nothing's been done, but I won't make any more comments about that. The other question I had for you is, when you're looking at this situation, is there any consideration for an individual's ability to pay?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, there is, because the homeowner is required to continue to make payments. If they miss one of those 15th of the month payments, the deferment period goes away.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, let me just back it up a bit. Representative Dabney, before they actually even go into this process, though, is there a consideration as far as should they be in this process in the first place, or is this just a plan for them to try and walk out on a mortgage payment here?
Actually, I would like to briefly answer the question as well as Professor Cox, I think, will provide Representative Anderson with a more technical response. The advantage in this bill actually is to the lender. As Professor Cox described, the foreclosure period in Minnesota can easily take 10 months to a year. Mm-hmm. If I'm notified today that my loan has gone into foreclosure, I have the option of simply stopping paying the loan. And the lender receives no revenue off of that loan while the process takes place. Under House File 3612, it's incumbent upon me as the borrower to continue to make payments and provide a revenue stream for that lender. So if I'm not able to make those payments, I am not able to access the right under House File 3612. But Professor Cox has, I think, a more technical answer to that.
Professor Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson. Anderson. Something can't lie again. If you're asking, are we evaluating the borrower's ability to pay and setting the amount of the payment, the answer, if that's the question, the answer is no.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Cox, what I'm asking is does the individual have the capability to carry on with their mortgage payment, and that they shouldn't be in this foreclosure position in the first place? I'm just concerned that there's an opportunity for fraud under this proposed legislation.
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that makes it more clear. If they can't make the payment, then they will lose their right to deferment almost immediately. If the borrower makes a misstatement in the affidavit, that's why we have some penalty in there for the borrower as well for making a knowing misrepresentation.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Cox, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, say you have an individual that says, hey, I can get a cheaper mortgage payment, because under this bill, as I understand it, they would go back to their original payment, so if they say they have the on a subprime loan, and so their original payment obviously is going to be much lower, and they'd be able to do that. And I'm just concerned that there's fraud, of the opportunity for fraud. They'd have how many a year that they'd be paying at a lower rate, and then they'd be done with their house if they didn't want to keep it at all. That's my concern. Does that make it more clear, I guess?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, now I understand the concern more. The obligations are still there on the borrower, so the mispayments would still be eventually owed by the borrower. It would be financially irrational for a borrower to make that move, except in rather unusual circumstances. You would ruin your credit. You would, for approximately 7 to 10 years, if you took that position. And very few people would do that in order to save 35% for 12 months, in my opinion.
Representative Anderson.
Well, I think you'd be surprised what people will do, especially if they decided to get into a loan situation where they couldn't afford it in the end. But that's my commentary, I guess. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Tripp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment, too, for my area out in greater Minnesota. And this is not altogether new to me, but in my locally owned banks in the little towns that I represent, and some folks that I know who have gotten into trouble and missed a house payment, or how many house payments do you have to miss before you go into foreclosure? And where I come from, my local banks call you and tell you that you have, or ask you why, and they ask if they can help you and refinance the loan. So, I mean, doesn't this happen any longer, or am I living in a different world, or what?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chris, I'll leave the technical answer about how long Mm-hmm. How many payments do you list before a bank or our lender, to be clear, lender initiates foreclosure to Professor Cox? But I think there's a variable number of period of time depending on the lender. I will say, however, I hear from both the foreclosure prevention community, the counselors working with borrowers, and from services, including large mortgage services in the state, the great frustration they have today in this new securitized secondary mortgage market environment that we're in, trying to figure out who you have to talk to in what office tower in Midtown Manhattan to work out that loan. And it's one of the reasons for this bill. People, perhaps in Faribault, where you walked into the bank, you had your tax forms and your W-2s, and you talked to the banker, and they looked you in the eye, and they said, okay, Jim and Patty will give you the loan. And then they kept that loan. You can go back to them because you know who it is. It's John at the bank. Mm-hmm. In many other places, including across Greater Minnesota, that office where you got the loan from the broker probably is closed today. Or even if it's open, they don't own the loan. The loan has been sold to a trust headquartered somewhere, which may have part of the loan, not all of the loan, and it's a much more complicated environment than we experienced probably even a decade ago, certainly 2 decades ago. And that makes providing assistance to people that much more time-consuming and a reason for the bill.
Professor Clark, do you care to answer the other part of the question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, 60 to 90 days, depending on the lender. I will add to what Representative Dabney said is typical, one of the reasons we exempted banks from the anti-predatory lending bill last year was the bank's representation, which I think is by and large true, that they did not originate a substantial number of the mortgages that are the subject of last year's bill, and that scope is in the limit on this bill as well. So the folks in your community who miss a payment likely don't have a loan from their local bank that would fall within the scope of this bill.
Representative,
thank you, Chairman. And to the testifier, then, my concern is, of course, for first and foremost, for my constituents who are in these situations where the, and I do have foreclosures in my district that I read too many in the newspaper lately, and I'm concerned, however, that there isn't enough being done and enough work being done with the local bankers in this bill so that the folks can work out work something out. What am I missing? I do understand that you get the deferment. I think that's a good idea. And yet I'm just concerned that it's going to take a piece out of there where that they can't work together with the local banker and refinance instead of having to go into a deferment and other options. What was wrong with what we used to do?
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, this allows exactly what you talked about. This allows the borrower and the lender to sit down and mutually work out an agreement that's to their mutual advantage. A refinancing, a restructuring of the loan, shifting payments around, whichever the case may be, whatever changes or new approach matches the needs of that borrower and that lender jointly.
Well, thank you, Representative Dabney, because that's what I believe needs to be done so that we can keep people in their homes and so that we can continue to make payments to our local banks so we can continue, so we can try to cure some of these ills of this economy. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions. One of them is on, when you talk on Section 3, page 215, we're talking about the right of foreclosure deferment. When I look at Finance and Commerce, where they're posting the public notice of a foreclosure, they will notify the origination of the loan amount, and then they'll show the amount of foreclosure. And what the lenders have done is they have loaded that up with all kinds of fees, attorney fees, foreclosure fees, and typically they load it with several thousand dollars in cost of foreclosure. So does that mean when you defer it, Sarah owes me $100,000. I go through legal fees and I tack that on the mortgage. So now when I do the foreclosure sale, the amount is $105,000. So what is she deferring? $105,000? So I've gone ahead and loaded that thing up? Or is she deferring the $100,000 at the time of the posting? And that's a big issue because they really load those things up.
Professor Cross?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I think that would be a worthy subject for evaluation on another day. And I agree with you. Some of those fees are ridiculous. And some of them are just a waste of money, like publishing and papers at hundreds of dollars that don't make any sense in the 21st century. They're win-win.
Right.
Having said that, the answer to your question in the context of this bill is whatever the contractual obligations are the contractual obligations. This bill doesn't change that. This is an emergency attempt to say stop, to give the thousands of people who are going to be thrown out of their homes otherwise, who would be eligible for this, the opportunity to see a federal solution develop. We have a bleeding heart Bernanke now talking about loan modifications to take enforced losses on lenders. This is really a crisis situation when you have the Fed chair talking like that. And this, all this does, to answer your question, is just call a timeout so the solutions are developed. We're not throwing thousands of people out of their homes. The obligations continue. If they were properly contractually imposed, then they'll be due. Although, if some of the federal solutions pass that are being kicked around now by bankruptcy reforms, they might be dischargeable at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But if you're really going to do it right, you got to think about the deferment starting at the point of the declared default rather than having it declare a notice of foreclosure, because that means they've assigned it to the legal people and they have filed the documents and the foreclosure and the late fees and everything just loaded up. And so what you're deferring is an additional big hunk of dough, which buries them deeper. A. B, now Sarah opts to pay the 65%. Now she is really in a negative amortization. But it exacerbates it even more. And so you may have deferred that thing for a year, but now the 105 with fees in a negative amortization ends up being 115 at the end of the year, and I loaded up some more with foreclosure notices and additional fees for loading at the end of deferment. Am I just beating up on Sarah where I shouldn't do that? I'm seeing that happen. I'm just wondering.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, again, what this bill does is provide the lender and the borrower time to negotiate a mutually agreeable and mutually beneficial agreement to resolve that individual loan's crisis.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am so sorry that I missed most of this testimony. I had an appointment at 11:30 with a very important subject with a constituent, and I just didn't feel like I could miss this, but I thought this would be done by 11:30. So I apologize. Representative Dabney, it seems like there still seems to be some unrest in some of the negotiation spots in the bill. You know, the definition of subprime, individual responsibility versus, you know, trusting somebody in engaging in a mortgage contract, that type of thing. What kind of resolution can you give to us that this bill will be worked on in between now and when it goes to Commerce? I presume it's going to Commerce.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, I've had numerous conversations with representatives of the lenders community since the bill was introduced throughout the week. I can assure you that those will continue as the bill moves, if or as the bill moves forward. And if I may, we've already expressed some willingness to discuss some certain specific things that have been raised that we would be willing to amend to be more of the liking of at least some elements of the lending community.
That you answered my follow-up. I was going to ask if there are some areas that you are willing to move on, or is this, you know, just a good foot forward type attempt?
I believe I've indicated that we are willing to look at the bill, and have already indicated that there's some areas that we could probably pretty quickly find some mutual agreement on carving some pieces into the bill or out of the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. And I'm sorry I missed some of the testimony, too, so I hope I'm not being redundant here. But so for the lenders, from the lender's standpoint, what do they gain and what do they lose by this bill? What would be a benefit to the lender as well?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi. The borrower and the lender gain time, which is something that both sides need at this point in our country's history. Secondly, and perhaps most importantly from the lender's perspective, I would suggest, they gain money. Under this bill, the borrower is obligated to continue to make payments towards the mortgage. As is, I believe, previously been stated, if you file a notice of foreclosure, provide me with notice of foreclosure today, I can essentially stay rent-free in my home for perhaps as long as a year with no revenue coming into that bank or that lender. I've never been a lender, but I assume that money coming in is better than no money coming in. That's been my experience as a borrower.
Representative Dabney, if I may ask you a question.
Certainly.
Let's assume that that the state of Minnesota chooses to do basically nothing, and that the federal government, as Representative Anderson indicated, continues to do nothing, and the housing crisis escalates, and housing values throughout the United States continue to plummet, as they are presently. In that situation, after another year in which foreclosures were moving forward, would it not be possible for the lenders to find themselves now owning properties that were significantly less valuable than they would have been if our state and the country can come up with some mechanism to slow this downward spiral?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the question. Yesterday, an economist with the Brookings Institution, a former Fed economist, was quoted, actually it's in today's Star Tribune, a quote from yesterday, that it's now looking like the bottom to the housing market will not come this year, perhaps not next year, and perhaps not until the year after that. While the focus today is on people in foreclosure, I'd urge committee members to think more broadly of the impact of that on all Minnesotans. And I'll share personally. Yesterday after session, I got home and brought in the mail where I found my home's assessed value for 2009 property taxes from the city of Minneapolis. I live in a nice middle-class house, in a nice middle-class neighborhood, in a nice middle-class city. And according to my city assessor, my home lost 17.5% of its value last year. It is now worth less than the purchase price and the cost of the remodeling that we did after purchase.
Took it down
17.5%. I got a neighbor on the block who just accepted a new job in New York State. I wonder what he thought as he's moving to put his home up for sale when he opened his assessed value report last night. What does that mean for people across the state as the real estate market continues to slip and slip? This deferment will stop foreclosed properties from being dumped on the market, slow the short sales being dumped on the market, and help to stabilize housing market and housing values for all Minnesotans, whether it's in Minneapolis or Minnesota or anywhere else across the state.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment on Representative Scalzi's point, what prevents a bank from doing this on their own? I'm sure they're in the business of getting money. They don't want to foreclose anymore. And maybe this is not a question necessarily for you, Representative Daphne, or for Professor Cox. Maybe this is a better question for the lenders. I don't know if we'll have an opportunity to hear from them. But it's my understanding that they wouldn't want to foreclose more than anybody else. So what are we going to really achieve by this? Isn't this something that they already have the capability to do? And isn't it a practice of them to try and work out a payment system so that a person can, so they can get that revenue that they're looking for?
Professor Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's really important to understand the context of what's happening here. We're talking about subprime lenders. The largest subprime lender in Minnesota during this period, AmeriQuest, doesn't exist anymore. Probably the second largest subprime lender during that period, New Century, doesn't exist anymore. Over 70 subprime lenders have gone out of business. This is not the banks. The banks will come testify and talk about this. But they told us last year, and I think they're right, they were not the prime originators of subprime mortgages. This is a very targeted bill. The foreclosures that we're having, that are happening now, occurred in a time that the steep rise began and this crisis occurred, in a time when the economy was doing just fine in terms of employment data and that sort of thing. The underlying long-term interest rates were just fine. So it's really important to focus on who the lenders are here. Most of these loans are owned by securitized interests. You have a hard time even finding out who to deal with. You wind up dealing with a servicer who is not the owner of the loan, who actually has an incentive, financial incentive, to gain money in foreclosure. That's really important to this discussion. This is a collapse of the subprime mortgage industry. It's the result of the lending practices of that industry, which were not the neighborhood banks, which were substantially not entities that even exist anymore. So having said that, yes, workouts can occur. There was a new report issued 2 weeks ago by a working group of state attorney generals that evaluated the claims of servicers in this area to working out loan modifications. And what they found was a very uneven record. Some servicers are working out loans with borrowers, doing their best. Other servicers are doing almost nothing, and other lenders are doing almost nothing. It just depends on who owns your loan. Lastly, ultimately, again, Chairman Bernanke is saying this now. This is not some crazy view. Ultimately, we're going to have loan modifications that recognize the losses in the loans for everyone's benefit, including the overall economy. That solution isn't here yet. The only question is, are we going to throw thousands more people out of the house while that, their houses while that solution is developing?
Representative Cox, in that regard...
Thank you for the promotion, Mr. Chair.
What did I say?
Representative Cox.
Oh, well, I'm not sure.
Promotion for the pay cut, I'm assuming.
Professor Cox. In that regard, when we were hearing the questions from Representative Fritz, we were discussing small banks, parts of the state and country where these kinds of loans are really personal. What we're talking about here is international banks and investment companies, pension funds and others who are totally separate and separated from, you know, individual borrowers. This is an international crisis possibly as well, and we know that the housing market, the housing part of the economy is a huge part of the of American economy as it is here in Minnesota. So are there any mechanisms presently that bridge this difference between small local banks who used to negotiate these loans and large multinational investment banks and houses and pension funds who simply see the money's not coming in and have to move to gain whatever resources they retrieve whatever they can. Is there any, there isn't any mechanism much, is there, presently?
Mr. Chair, the way I put it before is when people think of their mortgage lender, they often think if, you know, if they're really well off, they have Jimmy Stewart, otherwise they have Mr. Potter. You don't have either of those. Those guys are out of this subprime mortgage game as a whole. The typical subprime loan is financed by a Wall Street entity to companies that no longer exist. When I was lead counsel in the multi-state case against Ameriquest, that's then the largest subprime lender in America, we got to a certain point, and he said, well, I can't pay you that much money to pay all these people back. And the chief counsel pulled his keys out and threw them on the table and said, there's nothing for you to go after. You're in my building, and there's some computers, and that's it. You sue us, we'll implode, Wall Street will stop funding us, there's nothing there. And that is, in fact, pretty much what happened. So the answer to your question is, with these entities, is no. And borrowers have a real hard time getting anyone to make a decision because there is no local bank. There is no human being in the state of Minnesota, and they often can't find a human being anywhere who can make a decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill was just recently introduced, and I applaud your effort in, at least in trying to deal with the foreclosure issue because it is a crisis. But I have, as I've just been trying to get ready for this hearing a little bit, I wish that I would have had a little bit more time, and you have been very open to talking, Representative Dabney, to talking about this in the very short time that we have, and I really appreciate your openness and your knowledge on the issue. One of the articles, and I just a few minutes ago spoke to at least my concern is, you know, can we have some more discussions with the bankers and lenders to try to find some compromises like we did with the other consumer protection bills that you've carried in the past, because I was very pleased with that process and how everybody came together in agreement and able to support the bill. And as I've looked at this bill, though, one of the biggest red flags to me and one of my own personal concerns has been something I read in the Star Tribune from the quote by Art Rolnick. I don't know if you've already discussed this while I was gone. But he says that this bill is, or this movement is, unprecedented in modern times, and we should move forward with caution. He doesn't say we shouldn't move forward at all. He just says with caution, and I know you have been cautious, but I just need some comfort here. And then he goes on to say that there is reason for government to step in, but it should perhaps be limited to low-income borrowers who were misled. And those are two groups of people that I wish that this bill targeted a little bit more, possibly lower income and people who were truly misled by this whole movement. And so can I get some comfort from you, Representative Dabney, that we can talk more about those groups of people and how we can target this bill even more?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, I'm a firm and perhaps passionate believer in the legislative process, which requires conversation and lots of it often. That said, 30 to roughly 30% of the subprime loans written across the country in 2005 and 2006 are now on homes where the value of the home is below the principal on the mortgage. Received an email from Rochester this morning from a real estate agent who's handling somewhere between 40 and 50 bank-owned properties from foreclosures, all of them worth over $250,000 and some of them up to $500,000 in value, as they were originally priced. This is not, at this time, simply a crisis of low-income communities, central cities, or low-income borrowers. This is a crisis that is spreading across the across the state. The highest foreclosure rates in the state last year were in rural Minnesota. Rock and Traverse counties that saw a 200% increase in their foreclosure rates over 2006. So we can have conversations about targeting it, but we need to target it to meet the needs of all Minnesotans who are feeling the effects of the collapse of the real estate market.
Thank you very much. That does give me some comfort. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the...
Mr. Chair?
me.
I do have another question.
Dabney. Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'll identify yourself, use your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Al Hennigitz, and I live in Apple Valley, Minnesota. I am a music teacher, and I work out of my home. But I would like to...
Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here. What I would like to explain is how I got myself into this predatory loan or subprime loan. The gentleman, and I won't mention names right now, but I had been teaching him and his two kids in my music studio for about 5 years. So when I thought it was time for me to actually stop renting and getting into a home, I contacted this person, which I thought that we had some loyalty together. And he said, no problem, I'll take really good care of you. So since then, I also asked him to get me a 30-year fix and to go with the Dakota County first-time buyer's plan. And after hemming and hogging back and forth, he said, no, you don't qualify for that. And, you know, we just had a discussion on that. And then he got really aggressive and he started intimidating me that you should, if you get a 30-year fix, you're going to pay this much. But if you get like a 2-year adjustable, you'll pay just this much. And so I understood that it was going to be adjustable, but here's where he actually was lying to me. He actually said that if the interest rates go down, so will my payments. Well, I haven't seen that yet. After the 24-month honeymoon was over, and the teaser rate originally, by the way, was 6.9. Right now, it's 13.9. Every 6 months, it keeps going up, and there's no cap to it. Okay. He also said that after 6 months of the original date, that I could refinance. So after 6 months, I did go back to the broker. And then I discovered that if I did refinance that, I would have to pay prepayment penalties of anywhere from $4,000 to $6,000, plus new inspection fees, appraisal fees, and closing costs. So I was really stuck with my adjustable mortgage, which I found out that it was called an ARM. But I like to call it an arm and a leg that is costing me. Okay. Another thing that this wonderful broker that's still working out of Burnsville said that when the mortgage, when the interest rates do go down, that my payments will go down. But so far, I've discovered that my interest rates are tied up with the London industry, London Index, which is called a LIBOR, of which I didn't know what that was. At that time, I didn't clearly see what would transpire in the future. I trusted this gentleman to be ethical and straightforward, and all of that foreign terminology and unknown numbers were entirely alien to me. At the closing cost, the selling price of the house was like about $2,700. And in today's market, it's worth $250,000. Originally, he got me a loan with New Century Mortgage. And as we know, New Century has gone bye-bye since then. Since then, Carrington Mortgage will pick up the paper, and I have been trying my best to renegotiate with Carrington, and they're just hemming and hogging back and forth. I'm not getting too much results from them. one of the things that the broker did, it's to my unknown knowledge, because I am self-employed, I was requested that I provide like at least 3 years of back taxes, which then it did show that I was making about $3,000 a month. What he did, he actually changed, without my knowledge, to put on that application that I was making $10,000 a month. Now, ladies and gentlemen of this house here, if I were making $10,000 a month, I wouldn't be sitting here. Another thing that I also learned, and this is a terminology that hardly anybody knows what that is, it's called an annual yield spread. And that is a kickback from the lender, at that time New Century Mortgage, to the broker for talking me out of a lower interest rate that I would have qualified for a prime loan into the subprime loan. For that, he actually got approximately $5,000 kickback. Also, I didn't know that I was going to be involved with what is called a negative amortization, that no matter how long I pay on this, I would never pay it off. What this broker has done, he has actually placed his personal greedy interest before the interest of his customers. And my request, in his deceptive, nefarious deeds, he also violated the Mortgage Broker's Code of Ethics in the state of Minnesota. Okay. Right now, what I'm experiencing, I'm really shocked. I'm all stressed out. I feel really demoralized and really ashamed. I feel that, you know, me being a teacher, that I should have known better. But it's like, you know, all these numbers and new terminology I was not familiar with, and I really trusted him. So it's like, if your pastor says, you know, go here, well, he just trusts the word, and that's what I trusted him. All of this has really damaged my reputation, you know, and in my credit report, it's so bad right now that I can't even afford to finance a can of Calcat dog food. Right about now, I think I need a hug. Don't you? I had to change everything in my lifestyle to have it. I'm not purchasing any new clothes. Mostly, I eat once a day. I limit my driving distances. I conserve on water, electricity, and scrimp on everything. I'm fighting very hard right now to keep my home. It is my first home. You know, I was hoping to have the American dream. Instead, I got the American scream. I'm desperately hoping for some legal minds to actually help people, not only me, but also other people in the same situation that got themselves into this through no fault of their own, outside of, you know, not knowing what was going on. And like this broker actually took advantage of my trust with him. And, you know, and so far he's still out there doing business. He may not be doing subprime loans now, but he has just built a $500,000 office. And I'm sure on the backs of other customers like myself. Okay. So, and one more. I get this. On behalf of all the people who have gotten themselves into these bad loans, I would ask upon the servants of this house to be compassionate and to do the right thing and to do it the Minnesota way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hankins. Representative Dabney, do you have other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I do not, but I believe there are others in the audience who are interested in testifying on the bill.
Yeah. Representative Peterson.
How long are we going to go?
We will move as quickly as we can with other testifiers, and we are going to have a vote today. Are there others who would like to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And if you would like to identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Bankers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee today and share our thoughts on the foreclosure issue and specifically to Representative Dabney's bill. And I want to say up front, really appreciate working with Representative Dabney on a myriad of foreclosure and lending issues over the last couple of years. He's obviously a real champion on these topics, and we've had a very good relationship, and applaud him for bringing this forward today. I just want to make a couple of general comments. You know, the Minnesota Bankers Association has about 450 members representing about 95% of banks in Minnesota. So we represent large banks and small banks all across Minnesota. Probably almost in every one of your districts. This is one of my members. And our members are obviously concerned about the foreclosure process. Understandably, has a lot of people concerned, public, policymakers, people obviously in foreclosure ourselves. There's a lot of concern. Our members, as was kind of hinted at here a little bit, work to build a long-term relationship with our customers. That's our goal. Our banks have been in their communities, many of them well over 100 years. We strive to have work with them on their mortgage issues, their savings accounts, their checking accounts, retirement, you know, their products and services, their financial needs, and it doesn't serve us well to foreclose and move them out. I mean, we want to work with our customers. We're part of our community. We strive to build strong communities. For our banks to survive in the community, we need strong communities. If the community is weak, we don't have a bank there. So we want to be a part of our communities. We are part of our communities. We want a strong community. And we recognize and we know that foreclosure is not good for anybody in the process. We are working to help solve the problem. We're working with our customers. We're working with nonprofits and other folks like that. We're working with policymakers. This is a couple examples of that. The Minnesota Bankers Association recently set up a partnership with the Home Ownership Center. And the Home Ownership Center is a group that has a statewide reach to help folks with all of their mortgage issues that they may have. Counseling, help in that regard. It's statewide. It's a centrally located group, but they have they work through CAP organizations others across the state, and we have set up a partnership with them and actually working on a pilot project to do outreach to our customers in these banks that are working with them to kind of outreach and just, you know, say if you're having problems with your mortgage, you need to contact somebody. Here's someone you can contact. So that we're working with the Home Ownership Center. I think Representative Dabney mentioned earlier the Hope Now Alliance. I think you mentioned that. I just want to touch a little bit on that. That's a national group. It came together in October of counseling groups, lenders, servicers, all parts of the lending community to try and do an outreach to customers across the country to, again reach out for people that are in foreclosure to suggest to them that they need to get counseling, that, you know, don't sit on it. You need to call someone. Don't contact someone. And in Minnesota, I'm told that through January, they have outreach to about just under 13,000 folks in Minnesota. And that includes just under 1,700 direct counseling meetings. So the outreach letter and then the counseling together through January, just under 13,000. There's also another group that just came online about a month ago or maybe 3 weeks ago, Project Lifeline. Again, that's another group of national entities trying to reach out to folks, and their target is folks that are in severe delinquency. About 90 days late is their target, and they're going to, again, doing outreach to letters with letters and things to try and outreach to folks. So, and then the last point there is our bankers, as also mentioned earlier by one of our representatives, are working with their customers every day. They're just not going to foreclose on them, and they're going to work with them. They want to keep them. They want to help them. That's what our members do. So, again, I want to thank Representative Dabney for bringing this forward. But we just don't feel like this particular bill is one that can help us do the things that it says it can do. We don't support it at this time, and I brought along with me Mr. Cantor, who can maybe walk through a little bit of our specific concerns with the bill. So if the chairman would allow, maybe I can move to Mr. Cantor.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Cantor. If you want to identify yourself also and your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is David Cantor. I'm an attorney representing the Minnesota Bankers Association, and I'd like to talk about a few of the things in the bill that technically could cause problems as we go forward. One of the problems is that there is no universal definition of what a subprime loan is and what rate constitutes subprime rate. While the definition of subprime loan may have worked for Chapter 58, which is what this bill is relying on, if you look through the index and see what a practical application is, Mr. Johnson right now is passing around a chart which lists the index on which this rate is based. This I downloaded from the Federal Reserve site and reformatted it for easier reading. What Chapter 58 definition of subprime basically says is that for adjustable rate mortgages, a subprime loan would be one that is 2% over this index, and for fixed rate loans, it's 3% over this index, and for subordinate liens, it's 5% over the index. Now, this page that's been handed out to you is two-sided. On one side, it has the index for 30-year Treasury securities, which is the index, and on the other side, the 20-year. The reason we had both put in there, since 30-year is a typical loan, is because you'll note on the 30-year index, there's a lot of NDs there. That means not available, discontinued. The rate for 30-year Treasuries during from 2002 through 2006, 4 years of the period that we have in question here, was not available. So the Treasury has set up an adjustment factor where you use the 20-year index and you add or subtract to it. It depended upon the months that the loan was made. You add or subtract to it this adjustment factor, which ranges up to 0.2 of a point. So it's not an insignificant amount. But at any rate, what we're trying to do here is to show what great universe of loans the bill as currently written will encompass. You can see that the rates were low as in the mid-4s, and adding 2% in the case of an adjustable would take it up into the mid to high 6s, and adding 3 in the case of a fixed would take it up to in the mid to high 7s. So you can see that there's a wide universe of loans that are being brought in within the definition of subprime, and I would wager that there are borrowers right now that are in adjustable rate loans where if you offered to refi at a high 6 or a high 7 rate would say, give me some of that subprime right now, because that would really help me a lot. So I'm concerned about the wide range of loans that are going to be brought within the scope of this bill, and I'm not sure some of these people, if they can't do anything with a loan in the high 6s or high 7s, I'm not sure anything is going to help them out of their current situation. There are some other technical issues with the bill that I'd like to point out. I think it's good that the bill is requiring the borrower that they be a resident and intend to reside, but I think it would be better if we knew that they would lose the deferment if they did move out of the house. If the intent of the bill is to preserve home ownership, if they're not going to be there for whatever reason, even during the deferment period, if they decide to move out and rent for somebody else, it's not preserving a home for them. The delivery of the affidavit provisions, which I think are on page 3, I'm concerned that there are so many different people that it could be delivered to. It's not unusual with the mortgages being sold on the secondary market, as Representative Dabney pointed out. It's not unusual for out-of-state lenders to hold the mortgages. You could have a lender in California that has a name that's the same or very similar to a lender in North Carolina,
If the affidavit is delivered to a registered agent, it may be days, weeks before it ends up with the right lender, and the lender can respond as required under the statute. I think it would be better to have a narrowing of the people that it could be sent to. Each of these borrowers is getting a notice of mortgage foreclosure that clearly states the name and address of the attorney that's foreclosing the mortgage. That would probably be a better system for sending this through, so that there's no question and better chances that the sale will be stopped or the notice is given to the borrower that we're trying to preserve home ownership here. And on page 4, the minimum payment provisions do not address the issue of taxes and insurance. This is a long period of time that taxes are not going to be paid to the local municipality or the county. We certainly, if we're going to preserve home ownership, want to keep the houses insured in case something happens, so we need to address this in the section if we're going to do that. And the same thing would go with utilities, too. We would want utilities to be paid, because if our utilities aren't paid, we have potential problems running in deterioration of the home. There is a requirement on page 5, line 5.25, about the lender sending notice out to the borrowers would be eligible for this within 3 days. Now, if it happens that this bill becomes law on April 11th, which is a Friday, they would have to be sending out these notices by Monday, April 14th. Now, you can see from the chart in front of you that figuring out whether one of these loans is a subprime loan is not going to be easy, and we're expecting these lenders to do it literally within one business day after enactment. That just isn't going to work. They can try really hard, but it's a very difficult thing to do. So that's just too little time for us. The other problem that goes with that is if, because of the delays in the timing, a sale does go through when it should have been stopped, the only way to reverse that sale is to go to court and make a motion to the court to vacate the sale. That increases the costs involved to the borrower, the time involved, and we really shouldn't have to go through that. I sympathize with Representative Dabney that we're trying to act as quickly as possible to help all borrowers that are in this situation, but, you know, we've got to have some time to do it. We just can't do it immediately. The same thing with the notice of denial. Within 5 business days, I mean, I can understand completely the problems that a borrower would have figuring out whether or not they have a subprime loan. And so why not fill out an affidavit? I'll try. And so we may be hit with a flood of affidavits and not really have enough time to respond within the time that's set forth. And then there's the question, I think that Representative Dietrich brought it up, what happens next after we're all done? What happens to the not only the 35% difference in the interest that's being paid during the deferment period, but a cent difference in the interest that's being paid during the deferment period, but as Professor Cox said and Representative Dabney said, we have a period of missed payments before the foreclosure starts, 3 to 6 months. So now we have the 3 to 6 months of payments that were missed before foreclosure started. Then we have the deferred interest, and now the deferment period is over. What does the lender do? Does the lender now declare another default because the defaulted payments from before the deferment period aren't paid? The 35% interest isn't paid. What happens next for the borrower? Are we really just delaying the inevitable? So now they've had the free year, but if federal aid doesn't come, a federal remedy doesn't come, they're going to be right back in foreclosure. So that's another concern. I'm also concerned about the legislature modifying a contract and perhaps deterring the institutional investors that would normally provide the money for Minnesota mortgages from coming back into Minnesota. If they look and see that the Minnesota legislature is willing to modify a contract that they've relied on, what are they going to do next? Are they going to say, I'm not going to lend in Minnesota, or you're in Minnesota, I've got to charge you a higher rate because I don't know what the state of Minnesota is going to do to the contracts that I've relied on? These are issues that I'm concerned about in dealing with this bill. Lenders may start declaring defaults earlier instead of working with the borrowers. I don't know. Finally, there are a couple of constitutional issues. I'm not sure that this bill would survive constitutional scrutiny.
And generally, in looking at this type of a law, the courts will look to see if there is truly a bona fide emergency and what the effect is on the parties to the transaction. In the case of a bona fide emergency, we don't have the circumstances that we had in the 30s when many, many banks were closing and credit was not generally available. We also have much lower unemployment rates now than we did in the Depression. They may not be very good, but they're certainly a lot better than they were back then. So I'm questioning whether there's really a bona fide emergency. And it's hard, as I said, with this definition of subprime loan, whether the people in the high sixes, this is a bona fide emergency for them. The effect on the parties, we're not changing just the remedies here, which courts are inclined to give deference to in these kinds of circumstances, but also substantially modifying the terms. So those are the kinds of issues that I see technically with this bill, that it just, from my perspective, isn't ready to become law in its current form. But I thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for giving us the time to speak here.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor. Are there others who would like to speak on this bill? Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name and identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
Good afternoon, members. My name is David Skilbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. The association of about 300 locally owned community-based private banks in Minnesota with about 600 locations. My lenders, as some of the previous discussion looked at, are not the target of this bill, but in principle we do have two concerns about the bill in its current form. Number one is the previous testimony related to the definition of subprime. That gives us some concern that the net is a little bit bigger than the target it is pointed at, and therefore could bring in a couple of our loans or a couple of our lenders. Secondly, in principle, we would have great concerns and be opposed to proposals like this that extend the foreclosure process. Previous testimony indicated that currently our Minnesota law is one that has at least a 9-month foreclosure process, probably closer to a 12-month foreclosure process. And the 9 months is really the technical minimum foreclosure amount law. Once you send that 30-day default letter, then comes the reinstatement period, and then comes the redemption period. On a practical matter, as some other people have alluded to, it really becomes much more longer than that. As Representative Fritz referred to, if we have a lender with a borrower in default, we're going to call that individual, we're going to work with them. The last thing we want to do is foreclose, and we might end up carrying that individual for an extended length of time. I was just speaking to one of my lenders a few weeks ago, and he told of such a situation. The borrower was in default. It was not a subprime loan, but there was a job loss involved. The lender carried that individual for 8 months with no payments because there was an agreement and there was an idea that after this period of time there would be a resolution because of some outstanding other issues. That worked, and it was something that this borrower and this lender worked out on their own. And those are the sorts of things that lenders commonly do in order to extend that foreclosure process. We were one of many groups who participated in some working groups earlier this interim. Representative Dabney was on many of those groups. I too want to thank him for the work last year that he did on some consumer protection issues and for the work on bringing this issue to the table. I'll add, though, that the working groups on foreclosures that met and now have introduced probably about a dozen bills or so through the legislature this year, those groups considered virtually every idea possible to respond to the foreclosure crisis and the foreclosure issues. They did consider issues similar to this. And the consensus there, I believe, was that they concluded that the foreclosure process that Minnesota has and has currently is a very consumer-friendly one, a very long one, and therefore they did not come forward with a proposal like this. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Skilbred. We'll move on with the next testifier and then see if there are questions. But we do need to move on. We're getting close to 1 o'clock here. Welcome to the committee. If you state your name and identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Mortgage Association, and I will be exceedingly brief. Of course, all of the appropriate thanks to Representative Abney and the other legislators who have worked so hard on this issue. Our issue is this. As the chair indicated a bit ago, this is a crisis of international proportion. And as Professor Cox mentioned in his testimony, oftentimes you have to call mid-Manhattan to figure out what's going on with your loan. There's no question about that. It's indisputable that the funding for mortgages right here on Main Street or in our communities in Minnesota are funded by money that comes from a variety of sources, oftentimes national and very likely international. The number of mortgages that are set to actually have their adjustment period in 2008 is enormous. Those mortgages will reset, their option arms or those sorts of loans, and as everybody knows, this issue is actually going to get larger. So we have to be very circumspect about what we do if we would do anything that would cause a diminution in the enthusiasm for the loans given to Minnesota borrowers. We're very, very nervous about that. And folks say, but you know, Pat, you've made that argument before about chilling the mortgage market. And I have. But in this case, in such an unusual case, with the way the credit markets are tightening, not just for mortgage loans, but for student loans and car loans and every other facet of the credit market, we have to be very, very careful to make sure that we don't do anything that would be deleterious for our Minnesota consumers. And that is our largest concern. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Any questions from the committee? Anyone else who wishes to speak on this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you state your name and identify yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matthew Lemke. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein, and I'm here on behalf of the National Mortgage Bankers Association. And in light of the time, I will just say that we echo some of the questions that some of the other testifiers had, some of the technical questions about how things would work in a practical manner if this bill would become law, some of the constitutional questions, and I guess a public policy question going forward is if we are truly helping the borrower by deferring some of these payments. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony only to say I apologize. I have not had a chance to speak with the author before this, and I will make the commitment that I will do afterwards. So thank you,
Mr. Lemke. Anyone else here to testify for or against the bill? Representative Dabney.
Thank you. There was a couple of questions raised in the first testifier from the Minnesota Bankers that it doesn't speak to the paying of the continued paying of the taxes and insurance and maintenance of the property. And it would seem to me that would be a very appropriate attachment to this bill. The other part they talked about would be the time that it would take for this affidavit and the whole timing issue. How do we tie those ends together?
Representative Dabney.
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I've asked Professor Cox to return to the table to try to respond to some of those specific concerns.
Professor Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, very briefly, just one correction, the technical point. The testifier again said that all the notices would have sought within 3 days after the effective date. That only applies to people whose foreclosure scale is scheduled within 20 days after the effective date. Small number of people. Otherwise, it's 14 days. On to the points that you raised, I think that's a very valid issue to address. Currently, if you're in foreclosure, the typical subprime loans, unlike the loans that you're used to, do not typically have escrow provisions. Secure-type subprime loans were typically made without escrow. In foreclosure now, this long foreclosure period, there's no payments being made, and the lender would be often responsible for the taxes and insurance, or they simply let them accrue on their property. The same choices would exist here, except now they have money from the borrower to make that. So another way to look at it is the borrower pays 65% minus whatever the taxes and insurance are. One could argue that we should talk about whether we need to adjust that up to include those matters. I think it's a valid question.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you. Yeah, that would be my concern. If they're not paying their mortgage or can't pay their mortgage, they probably aren't paying the utilities and taxes either. So you've got this compounding going on.
Mr.
Representatives, Mr. Cox, excuse me, I keep wanting to send you in the wrong direction here.
Sorry, I'd be happy to work with you. Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I do think it's something that we can talk about. The basic answer is there are going to be payments, and only people who can make substantial payments can take advantage of this, or else they'll immediately lose the right on the first month. The amount of that, the question then becomes, what is the amount of that payment relative to all the obligations? And I think we can continue to work on that while we address issues like whether it should be 5 days or 10 days in a notice.
Can that happen if this bill moves on?
Definitely.
You need a hug too, don't you?
Well, I'm not sure a hug would help. Legislative process, Representative Peterson, we keep talking.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess that was just the question about the mortgage or about the taxes. I believe most people's mortgages have the taxes and insurance rolled into that. I mean, that would be probably up, wouldn't that be up to the mortgage or the lenders to make sure that they're paying those into escrow so that they can be paid, or would they take the 65% just pay off the principal and interest and not make those payments for the taxes and insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, as Professor Cox stated, unfortunately, it was not uncommon with subprime loans for there not to be an escrow account. One of the challenges we struggled with last year on the predatory lending bill was the was in fact requiring that brokers notify clearly borrowers whether their quotes included taxes and interest or merely principal and interest.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Cox, I really look at this. We know one victim of this bill, and that's the person that received the subprime loan. And is there any other victims that we're creating with this piece of legislation that we should be aware of? And if so, how are we doing that?
Representative Dabney.
I believe that was directed to Professor Cox.
Professor Cox.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are the people that bought the mortgage from Ameriprise and all this that own those now could be a local banker, could be a host of people. Are we making victims out of them because they didn't know, they didn't research a person's background, they didn't know that 60% of a person's gross income is going to make this house payment. They should have done enough due diligence before they take over a mortgage, but certainly these people weren't the most scrupulous people in the world anyway. So I just wonder, are we creating victims out of those people?
Professor Carr.
What would be the ramifications of doing that?
Mr. Chair, this is where Representative Dabney will hit me over the head. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've come here and given you very technical answers to bills over the past. I get really angry about this one. I've been, the first case I did on this was 10 years ago, and this industry was rapacious, it was wrong. This crisis was predictable and it was preventable, and I predicted it. And it's not something like it could have been. Now, I've been screaming about these people were out of control, and they created a global financial crisis. When you get questions like that, why I get angry is I have no sympathy at all for the investors in these loans. These were, these are investors who bought tranches and these securitized loans. They took their chances. They were dumb or whatever they were. And they're going to take a beating, and they were greedy, and this whole thing was greedy. We've got people who are some of the wealthiest people in America, such as the owner of AmeriQuest, who I think, and I will one day be bopped on the head for this, somebody should consider putting an orange jumpsuit on. I don't understand how we let this thing go the way we let it go. Now, having said that, the answer to your question is I have no sympathy for the investors. They were sophisticated people, or they should have been sophisticated. There were Norwegian public schools who got caught up, But I think the bottom line on this is if we don't act, we're dumping all these properties onto the market with no plan. There's a lot of talk, but there's no plan. And there has to be a plan to address this at the federal level. And the only question we have is that we're going to throw all those houses onto the market now, throw all those people out who can make very substantial payments that shows the good faith and the possibility. We're only talking, by the way, in this chart. You can see we start out with the number of foreclosures in the dark class, and you get each of those conditions brings it down to the red, and then within the red, they still have to be able to make the payments. So we're targeting this in a way that we're trying to, as best we can, identify the people who have a chance to wind up on the other end, still in control of their home. It's not only good for them, it's good for the communities that you don't dump that in. It's good for the real estate market not to be dumping all those properties back and eliminating the possibility of those people ever be homeowners again. And I'm sorry for going on.
Thank you. Anyone else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I missed this part. And Representative Nelson had asked the question of, does that 65% of the ones that have the taxes and the insurance, they had that in escrow? You had mentioned that a lot of them didn't have an escrow, but what does happen if they do have an escrow? Are those taxes paid? Is the insurance covered? Or is that an additional cost then to the, will the lender then be required to pay that? What happens in that situation?
Representative Dabney or Professor Cox?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, as it's currently structured, it says 65% of the monthly payments, so they would have to pay 65% of the escrow, presumably, but we need to clarify that. That was actually a very valid point I thought was raised to get rid of that. That is the one point I thought was a valid point of ambiguity that we should address in the bill as we go forward.
Representative Peterson.
If they are not making their mortgage payment, they are not paying the escrow. So it isn't there.
Representative Dabney, are you prepared to renew your motion?
I am, please.
Representative Dabney renews motion to pass House File 3612 as amended, and we refer it to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate everyone's patience and consideration.
Committee is adjourned.